I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today with us. Writer, director, producer Anne Shin from the Fathom Film Group is here with us today to talk about her new film, The Superfood Chain. Anne, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So, return guest.
Yay, yes. I always love talking with you, so it's wonderful to have this opportunity. It comes like once every year or two.
Right, right. Yes, this is, I think this might even be our third chat. It's, same. I enjoy it as well. Thanks for that. So tell us a little bit about this film. I mean, it's going to be, it's going to exist on TVO's website, kind of hopefully access in perpetuity, but it's going to be playing at an environmental film festival. Maybe we can ask you a question about why is it at that kind of a festival, you know, Planet in Focus and so on. Superfood Chain sounds self-explanatory, but can you provide us a bit of context?
Sure. So the superfood chain takes a look at the butterfly effect of you or me going to our supermarkets and buying, you know, the latest superfood off the shelf. How does it affect farmers or fisher folk around the world? The question that came up during dinner with my family and set us off on the road to like four different locations.
Yeah, it's quite a world tour for you.
It was. It was spread out over a couple years, but it was really illuminating. We went to Bolivia, Ethiopia, Philippines, and Haida Gwaii in the west coast of Canada.
You say right at the outset, and by the way, congratulations, and some gorgeous images and so many great questions raised. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but I think we have anyway. But to me, the sign of a great film is that you go in thinking it's about this and you come away going, hang on a minute. There was a little bit of misdirection going on there. There's a whole lot more going on here than meets the eye. And I mean, you've touched on so many international development issues and global issues, frankly.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a bit of like, you know, pulling the string and pulling a thread and finding a whole lot unraveling in a good way. I was first kind of as a consumer who will kind of, you could say, fall victim to the latest superfood trend. I will buy what looks interesting and nutritious. And
are you eating cricket powder yet?
My daughter she's gutsier than me. But I wanted to kind of see, like, who's behind the marketing and who's benefiting from it. Mm. And that actually led me to people who are sometimes benefiting and sometimes not. It led me to get to the farmers and the fisher and to get more connected to the sources of this food. And that really opened up questions about sustainability and the interrelationship between like consumers and the growers of the food that happen to be halfway around the world. So yeah, it brings up issues of development, sustainability, and land rights for farmers in developing countries.
Do you think you went in kind of with, and it's really interesting, and I definitely want to talk a little bit about the fair trade sort of discoveries that you made along the way, but was it more of an economic kind of angle you were taking or more of an ethical approach to say, gee, I wonder, you know, who is in this supply chain?
Yeah, I thought at first it would be just to see who's benefiting from it. You know, is it the middle person? Is it the
right
marketer? Or, you know, but it did lead to some really complex ethical questions.
Mm.
Like, is it better to buy a superfood from a far-off location, or is it better to buy locally grown foods?
Right.
Who's, you know? I can tell you the answer, but or you could all go and discover it for yourself.
That's right. Go and
take a trip.
That's right. Well, this is what I find so interesting about it. And let's go back to that opening. So I think it was the opening line. Your establishing shot. We're in Toronto. Just gorgeous photography of the city and so on, and throughout the film. But you say you were always sort of under the impression that, you know, love made the world go around, but you're actually kind of coming on board with this idea. You think maybe it's really food.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how it's really we all need to eat. And what I discovered on this journey was that most established communities will have their traditions, and the food that they eat is grown in their areas, and there's a kind of a tradition and a body of knowledge around how you prepare it, all the different ways you can prepare, for instance, quinoa. It could be molded into fists. That becomes like a little lunch thing. It could be, you know, made into pudding. It could be put into soup. There's all these different ways that they prepare it that's, you know, been cultivated over generations in their culture. But then when people in North America, like myself, pick it up, it's kind of like, oh, so this is a superfood. They've either ground it into a powder, you put it into a smoothie,
right,
or you boil it like rice and you eat it. You know, we just don't really, it's fully out of context.
We're really disconnected from that sense. And it's an easy criticism, I suppose, to level at the West and with all our busyness and being over-programmed and so on. But But there's a sense, and that I think that's the sense you were getting to, is that sense of community, of relationship. This is about families. This is about this really makes contact with reality in meaningful ways.
Mm-hmm. It really does. I mean, it was great to sit down with the family in Bolivia and have lunch in the courtyard, which is the earthen floor courtyard in their home. And just to eat on a blanket that was laid out, and it was their homemade cheese and potatoes and tomatoes from the garden. That was the lunch, and it was actually really delicious. All the different pieces were delicious. And then when you consider the other end of the spectrum, it was interesting to see how, I mean, global food trade is wonderful and for us and for other people in so many ways, but it also causes issues around sustainability or disruption of food sovereignty. For instance, with Bolivia, when Western cultures adopted quinoa as a superfood, the demand went through the roof. Mm-hmm. And so all the Bolivian quinoa was being exported at a top dollar, and farmers were benefiting from it, but local Bolivians couldn't afford to buy quinoa anymore. So they were eating pasta and white carbohydrates.
Right.
You know, so it was ironic that, you know, we were starting to buy quinoa and they were starting to eat pasta. I mean, I don't think it was that straightforward of an equation, but the correlation is definitely there. The prices have since dropped.
Right.
For quinoa because, you know, it's being produced in Canada, America, Spain, China. So lots of people can afford quinoa now, and lots of people can eat it. And I suppose that is now a food crop that's matured. But that original price spike and the drop really caused a havoc in the Bolivian, amongst Bolivian farmers and Bolivian communities.
And then it's something, I mean, it's what we don't normally think about. We are so disconnected. It's in a bag on the shelf, and it's quinoa. I mean, why would I think about somebody else or somebody else's livelihood or whether or not they're getting paid a living wage or how this is actually affecting them, right? I mean, we're so, and I don't know if there's an answer for that. And I know that's not kind of what you were trying to do in the film, but I think it's really cool and fascinating about storytelling how you just mentioned you raised some really interesting ethical questions, ethical questions.
Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, what, like, on the one hand, if you buy fair trade, chances are what you're buying is you're actually helping the farmer abroad. So that's a good thing. It is good to do your homework a bit to know that the fair trade organization is doing something.
Right.
But I think it's also good to buy locally. It's because you're going to be more connected with the food. It's going to be fresher, and it won't, you know, it won't be irradiated or any of those other things that happen to food when they're shelved or put on containers to be shipped. And, you know, it doesn't, it's just all around better for you. You're supporting the community of farmers around you. So that's another kind of consideration.
Well, and you make a real decision, a real conscious decision as the writer-director on this one to step into the story. And you say, I wanted my kids to feel more connected. And so you planted a garden. And,
yes.
And you really rolled your sleeves up.
Yeah. It was really good to do because I was living in a place where a lot of the yard, it was a house in downtown Toronto with a yard and a lot of asphalt between myself and the other house.
Right.
And a lot of the yard had trees or was sloped. So the only place we could really plant was next to the asphalt. So it was this real ghetto garden. We planted some tomatoes and zucchini and you could see how hard it was to get this thing to grow, these things to grow, one, because of the light wasn't hitting it properly and just really began to appreciate it. For one, it was kind of a joy for my daughters every time they would come home from school, they'd check to see what's budded or what's growing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it also, yeah, it was. It's a great sense of kind of incorporating, you know, the earth and the rhythm of the earth into your daily life. But it really was a little bit of an experiment rather than, you know, anything close to trying to build a sustainable garden or diet.
That actually sounds the title of a book you should write, Sustainable Yes. Ghetto Gardens. I think that could be a bestseller.
I think, yeah, I'm gonna give you royalties.
I'll take them, yeah.
Okay.
And I will sample any of the food out of the garden. How's that?
Okay, I'll make sure there's no cars parked near the garden.
Yes, good call. There's a guy that you. I mean, many people that you talk to and families that you visit, and I love the way you make it so intimate and personal. You cross the globe, and you connect us all through food, and you know you again. You opened up the film with saying, "I want to feed my kids healthy food," and isn't that kind of what most of us want to do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a great leveler.
Yeah, it is. I mean, every family we went to, so Susan and her son and her cousin and her nephews in Philippines, Jeff Guan and Jalin in Haida Gwaii with their kids, and Pablo and Nilda in Bolivia, and Teje in Ethiopia with his children, and they all feed the kids different things, but it's
yes.
all healthy, and it's all very tied to their land and their climate
right.
and the crops that have grown in their area for a long time. And so you begin to see how, you know, as a human being, you don't actually need those particular superfoods from each of these different countries
right.
to be healthy. Like Teje in Ethiopia, who lives mainly on teff, which is high in protein and iron, and is a so-called superfood. He lives mainly on that and vegetables and some meat and dairy. And they're doing wonderfully, and that's very different from, you know, the seafood and the berries that Jeff Guan and Jalin would forage for. And they also go to their supermarket and buy bread and everything else, but they will forage from their environment and also fish for salmon. And mm-hmm. so their diet's very different, but the kids are all healthy and they all look very healthy and they're thriving. So that was an interesting comparison.
We need to talk about Teje's son, by the way. I think he's hysterical, and I'm so glad you included some of his comments and insights, because he touches on a lot of things that I think we definitely need to talk about in this, you know, age of globalization. You know,
I know.
He
wants to be a soccer star
and make lots of money at it, right?
Yes.
Which I thought was
yeah.
great. So good ambitions, I think. Yeah, that's all
yeah,
good. But
yeah.
I love the stuff that he says about women and men
mm-hmm.
and his comments on gender. I mean, and he does it with a smile. Grade 8. How old would you be? Mm-hmm. 14, 13?
13, yes, around 12 and 13, 12-ish. But he looked younger. He's slighter as a boy. But
right.
He does a lot around the farm. Yeah, I loved how he was saying how Mom does everything.
That's right.
She cooks, and then she goes out and helps on the farm and makes the lunch and takes the lunch out to my dad. And all the men have to do a bit of work and then come home and complain all day. But the women have to wake up and milk the cows and do the laundry and feed the kids, and work on the farm too. So he was like, when I grow up, I'm going to hire a maid for my mom.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that. That line about all yeah. my dad, basically the paraphrase is all my dad has to do is come home and after a day of work and sit around and complain.
Yeah, and complain.
It's just the funniest thing. But I think there's a pretty deep insight into that. And I mean, I just couldn't help but smile. And you can't hide this stuff from kids, right? I mean, this is... They notice these things, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and they're picking up on stuff. But I love the fact that he wants to step outside of that, it seems to me. Or maybe mm-hmm. he's already outside of all of that and kind of observing mm-hmm. it and making some pretty mm-hmm. kind of profound statements about
yeah.
about gender.
Well, it was so interesting to film that because the mother, like lots of women who have children, will incorporate the child rearing into their day. And
yes.
for those women who have to work also, and for her work was at her home and, you know, around her home on the farmlands. And so I lost the shot when we were filming, and she's like, cooking and she's mashing the teff and stuff. And she's got a baby on her boob, so she's feeding a baby while she's macerating the teff. Like, she could have been doing something else, I'm sure, but we just didn't have the right angle to catch it.
I was fortunate enough to have worked on a project years ago in Burkina Faso, and mm-hmm. and we were in the capital city, Ouagadougou, and you got to love a place with a name like Ouagadougou. Anyway, there around the city, trees had died, and sculptors had come around and carved these wonderful sculptures out of these dead trees. I don't know what kind of wood it was, but I'm sure it was, you know, hardwood of some kind. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was this strong female, clearly a farmer. She's got a baby on her back in this, you know, imagine this beautiful wooden sculpture. And mm-hmm. she's got a hoe in her right hand, and she's got a pail of water in her left hand, and on her head she's got a plate of, you know, vegetables, food, or something along those lines. And we're in this car, and there's five or six of us, and I look over and I said, wow, couldn't we get her to do anything else? Like, really?
Her
Are you
back.
Kidding
There's
me?
Nothing, she's not swinging anything on her back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a little wasted space there. Yeah. And her husband's probably trailing, you know, 2-3 meters behind her smoking a cigarette, right? You know what I mean? Like, I just couldn't help but laugh. But it really comes out beautifully in your film. And this is about community and about being connected. And this is just kind of the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess in a lot of farm communities, it's still the roles where women do a lot of the child rearing and help out on the farm. So, yeah.
It's not either or. It's clearly a both and.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, too, though, the children get involved as well. Like, all the siblings were all part of the teff kind of harvesting and
right.
And so, yeah, it's, I mean, I grew up on a farm, and that's kind of interesting. That's part of the bonding element of farms is you need a lot of hands. And when you're harvesting, you need to borrow hands. And so people come over and they help you out, and then you feed them, or you do a kind of like a harvest festival. In Ethiopia, what they do is they do a coffee festival at the harvest of teff. So all the people have come to help out. And then, they will kill a rooster.
Oh, okay.
They will kill the rooster on the threshing floor of the teff. And then sprinkle the blood and stuff. And then they'll do a coffee thing. They'll roast coffee and bring it around to everybody and feed them coffee and also a meal. So it's quite elaborate.
Quite elaborate, quite mm-hmm. rooted in tradition. I loved, I don't know who it was, but somebody near the end of the film said the phrase was tradition is just life, was the line. And I just thought that was a beautiful phrase and a beautiful thread throughout the whole film.
That was Jalen. It's true. He was saying it's not like something you read in a book and you try and incorporate into your life or you hear about. Tradition is what you've learned in your life from your parents and your grandparents, is what you do with them and what they've taught you. So yeah, it's just life.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned earlier this bodily knowledge, this passing on, right? It's almost as if these young kids are being mentored in a very different way. Here we are, we send our kids off, and we're currently doing it. We're sending our kids off to school and so on. But in this kind of a community or these kinds of farms, there really is this elbow knowledge, this standing side by side. I love the shots. I don't know what they're doing with the teff, but I guess they're throwing it back and forth. I thought they were playing a game of some kind, the kids, but I'm imagining they're actually trying to separate
the grain from the chaff.
You know, the thing that really struck me again, and I don't spend a lot of time on farms, but is the amount of work. It's just so top heavy on pretty much every level, and the Bolivian family, was it, they get up at 4:30 a.m. to cook their meals for the day to take out into the field to get the work done. It's mostly, in a lot of cases, just to provide for the family, and then if there's some left over, that we can actually take to market.
Yes. Well, they were, I found all the farming families were very, very, they're, I hope you can edit this. Sorry. A lot of farmers were very, very precise about what they would set aside for the market and what they would have for the cat family.
Oh, okay, yeah.
For instance, with the Bolivians, they, you know, the amount of land that they devoted to quinoa crops changed with the changing demand.
Right.
So meanwhile,
globalization, economic issues, and so on. Yeah.
So he had normally planted like four fields of quinoa, but now he only had like half a field planted with quinoa. And he wasn't even going to take that to market because the price of quinoa has dropped so much. It's not worth his time.
Right.
What the price of heirloom black potatoes had gone up in the local markets. So a lot of the fields were devoted to potatoes, and those were going to go to the market. So it was interesting to see how he had divided up his crops. And it was really about a function of what he could get at the market.
Tell me a little bit about that. That seems like a nice launching point. You know, I think you admit in the film that you were skeptical about fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of, you know, can I say it changed your mind with respect to that? I mean, can we ask, you know, is it about fair trade on all levels, or is it more about a living wage, or what's your sense?
Yeah, what happened was that as I was doing this film and researching it, my ideas around superfoods or my understanding of superfoods became a bit more nuanced. And I thought, you know, superfoods are healthy for you, but heck, so is a lot of other things.
Right,
are local and ready at your fingertips and don't require, you know, huge footprint in terms of air travel or any kind of those kinds of resources that are required to ship food from one country to another. So my sense of superfoods is that they are really not all that. There's a lot of marketing. They are healthy for you, but there's a lot of great nutritious foods you can find around you that are also good. So then I thought similarly that fair trade is probably a hyped up term. But in fact, the fair trade organizations I had the good fortune of like getting to know more are doing a lot for the communities. So in the Philippines, the fair trade community, the fair trade organization there was helping farmers not only by getting them machines so they could process their coconuts and sell them so they could be turned into virgin coconut oil. So they're getting machinery and equipment that farmers couldn't otherwise afford. But they were also lobbying and fighting to help the farmers retain their land because the farmers were being forced off their land by business interests. So the Fair Trade Organization did way more than just get a fair dollar for their farmers. They were helping them in so many ways. And I think that any legitimate fair trade organization is doing that for their farmers. Mind you, there is the issue of some fair trade organizations being a bit of a sham.
Right.
So it's a little bit of a consumer beware kind of situation where it does help to research it a bit.
Yeah. Oh, and for sure, the Canadians who are listening, Fair Trade Canada for sure is a place to go and to find out more information about the labeling and what goes into it and why. And you even mentioned that why things cost a little bit more, or maybe in some cases a lot more. You know, and as you point out, I think you said that you'd be happy to pay a little bit of extra if you knew in certain cases this was actually, you know, getting to the right people and so on and supporting the right initiatives.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's you know, it could be kind of almost like if you buy a record and you're supporting this band that you like. You know, it's a bit of a stretch, I suppose. But
a little bit, but it's still good.
Yeah. You know that, like, if you're buying Bolivian quinoa, you are helping the Bolivian farmers if it's a fair trade, particularly.
Yeah, that's good.
And
you're supporting your local indie band.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, rather than going for the AI bot produced music.
That's right. That's right.
On the airwaves or something like that.
I was fascinated by the fact that superfoods, $130 billion a year, I think you tell me a bit about that trendiness and what you did. I mean, did you make any big discoveries around that sort of the sham-like nature of it? The kiwi story is hilarious around kiwi fruit. I had no idea about that. I'm sure there's lots of stories like that.
Yeah, the kiwi story is about how it was originally called the Chinese gooseberry,
and which just doesn't really, with due respect to the with due respect to the gooseberry, it just doesn't sound all that enticing.
Yeah, until New Zealand growers started to grow it, and then they decided to just call it kiwis, and that just took off for some reason, and then suddenly the kiwi fruit became popular globally. I think that superfoods, as I mentioned before, like, they are nutritious for you, but they're not, you know, you could say the kale is a superfood. And until it was identified as a superfood, people didn't really eat it, even though there was a lot in North America, right? So it is a bit of a marketing ploy to get some food flying off the shelves. And I think there's an interesting reason why people like myself will fall for that, because we live busy lives. We live in polluted urban centers. We think if there's one thing we could do for ourselves or our families, it's to, you know, put something extra healthy on the table as if to offset all the other negatives about our lives. And so we'll be like, okay, we'll buy a superfood and maybe that'll help balance things out, you know, balance out our diet or balance out our stressed lifestyle. And I think that's kind of partly, you know, what's in the back of our minds as we think, okay, let's buy something extra healthful. So that, I think that's part of the appeal of something like superfood.
Just justify that $8 smoothie.
Yeah. And I bought some. So my kids like them, too.
Oh, they're fantastic, right? But there's a part, every time I drive by a booster juice, I mean, I don't know what you're boosting. I think it's clearly your bank account, but I don't know. I mean, they're tasty, right? And I'm sure they're very healthy. But I think I love what you've brought out in this. I mean, there's so many things you've brought out in the film, but I love how you are hoping that we're going to, I don't know, get a little more connected locally, be concerned about others, obviously, think about, you know, get out from behind our fences and our backyards and so on, think about other countries and other people and the impact of our decisions and so on. But, you know, it's about family. It's about staying rooted and connected in community. I love that. Yeah. I mean, if you had to answer the question, so Anne, what's the film about? Do you have that quick elevator speech? Because it's kind of not about superfood.
Yeah, it's about our interconnectedness. Like, each time we take a moment to question, what is it that I'm buying on the shelf? Where is it from? It's going to take us to, you know, more awareness and more connectedness to, one, what the food is, where it's from, who's grown it. And in that way, you make a much more meaningful kind of impact in terms of how you buy something, knowing where the money's going, and you feel more connected to your food and the growers of your food. I think fair trade organizations provide that kind of, you know, middle step where they bridge the consumers in you know, developed worlds with growers in developing worlds. And so that's definitely one way to help foster that sense of, you know, a meaningful purchase of food and knowing that it's going to a good cause and helping out the farmers who've grown it.
Well, it's connected to other industries too, right? I mean, just last week, the government released something I've been involved in fairly intimately as a report, a government human rights committee on supply chain transparency legislation, and Canada's been kind of lagging behind on that. And, you know, with respect to garments in particular, you know, how could we let Canadians know? Because I think we kind of are working on the assumption that a lot of folks, maybe not everyone, but a lot of folks are happy to pay a little bit more if they knew some of these things were actually, you know, I don't want to use the word policed, but managed well.
For sure, yeah.
You know, makes
sense.
Sure.
And it works also even for, like, local made products.
Sure it does,
I mean,
yep.
Shinola, which is started up in Detroit, their products cost a little more because it's all produced in America with fair wages. And that's the real cost of these items. And so people who buy that product know that where their money's going towards, and they're kind of supporting their local manufacturer.
I love the both and again angle to it, because how do you keep rooted? How do you stay focused in the present with your family and yet also, you know, concerned about this this world we live in, you know, the environment, mm-hmm. the climate, others, other people, other economies. Mm-hmm. It sounds so crazy big, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is
mm-hmm.
this is a way we can take part in a mm-hmm. kind of a simple way, you know,
mm-hmm.
if we're of means. So tell me, we got to wrap it up in the next minute or two. But I know you're working on some pretty interesting projects. I'm starting to see a bit of a theme, I think.
Yes.
But tell me about sewage.
Yeah.
And also about cognitive enhancement drugs. I don't even know what that is, but I think I want some.
Okay. So yeah. And you know, a direct result after you eat, sewage.
That's right.
Another producer and director at Phylum has been developing a documentary about how now human sewage can be processed and transformed into energy and water. So it takes an age-old problem, something that's often defiled our water and, you know, been a problem of dumping across borders and everything. Now it's becoming a resource, a renewable resource. We keep renewing. And so that's an interesting project that Hannah Donegan is doing.
Sewage is not going away anytime soon, right? I think we're pretty clear on that.
Yeah, yeah. And interestingly enough, there's a plant in Vancouver that's being built that is incorporating some of this great new technology.
Mm.
We find it in China and Germany and in Africa, and now it's great to find it in countries where, you know, the cities are already developed and they already have sewage treatment plants, so it's hard to replace them with a new technology
right.
treatment plant, but it's happening in Vancouver. And then another film that's going to be coming out soon, which I'd love to talk to you about at some point, is about cognitive enhancement, and that's about it's really a kind of a white-collar trend that's been happening. University students and professionals or shift workers will have been using different kinds of cognitive enhancement drugs, anything like Adderall, modafinil, or sometimes they will repurpose ADHD drugs just to help them stay awake or keep focused. And it's interesting.
Is this Bradley Cooper in Limitless? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's definitely, it's about the culture of biohacking.
Right.
And we take a fellow out of Vancouver, a futurist named Nick Badminton, goes on a journey as he explores different types of biohacking.
Sounds
and
fantastic.
Tries different cognitive enhancement
drugs.
Can't
wait to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds really good. I bet you there's all kinds of insights there.
Mm.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, thank you. Thanks so much for your time today. We've been chatting with Ann Chin, talking about her new film, The Superfood Chain. Going to be on probably the best place to see it. It's going to be at the Planet in Focus Film Festival coming
yes.
up very this, soon. Look it up.
Yeah.
But also
this Sunday.
Also
this Sunday, October 28th at 1 p.m.
October 28th, 1 p.m. And also mm-hmm. existing on TVO, hopefully in perpetuity. Everyone needs to see this, Anne. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.